Dr. Hixon, light of my life and friend of the podcast.
Oh my gosh, Reva, I feel like today is a big day. Thanks for inviting me back.
Always.
It's a big day. It's a big day for us.
It is a big day for us. We are here to introduce our labor of love.
Yes, you might have suspected, listeners, that we are co-conspirators of many varieties, as you've heard us on this podcast before. So yeah, Reva and I are here to announce a big project that is the labor of love that Reva mentioned, and it's called The Kiln. And we're going to tell you all about it today. We're so excited you're listening, and we are excited to get into more trouble together at The Kiln.
Yes, official high-level trouble.
Yeah, so as you've been listening to Reva on the podcast, we have been also parallel planning this project. And so we basically hang out every Wednesday and talk shop and dream together about what we want to do with our careers and how we want to support the field and how we want to support good work in the field. And so that really independently led us to thinking of this idea of like, oh my gosh, we want to have a school together. So I don't know where to start. There's so much to say, Reva.
Let's fucking get into it. Yeah. So you've obviously been in counselor education for a number of years. I've just gotten into it officially in the past year or so. I think the fundamental, foundation of our partnership has been that we came together deeply bothered and concerned about some of the patterns and trends and tendencies and directions that we see in this field. I'm remembering just before we started recording, I was remembering hanging out in that coffee shop in late 2019, right before the pandemic, and being like, okay, we're going to write this article and we're going to call it A Therapist Can't Say That. And then I was like, actually, I think maybe I want to start a podcast. Is that okay with you? And here we are now. So we did not know how large this was going to loom, not just in regards to the podcast, but that we were going to take these deep concerns and irritations that we had and turn them into an institution. We're institutionalizing it. And we are trying to take ownership of influencing the field in the direction that we want to see it go to the extent that we can. That's how I would put it.
Right. And you don't do something like this unless you really care about the profession. And both of us really care about clinical work and clinical training and clinical supervision. And, those irritations we have are those, the other side of that is passion. The other side of that is commitment, dedication. And we're both just intense enough to kind of express both sides of that.
Totally. We deeply give a shit. And I have said before that criticism is one of my love languages. I understand it is not an appealing one, but if I care enough about something to really criticize it, I'm invested. And that's how I am with this field. So exactly. It is the other side, irritation and passion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, should we tell our lovely audience, the two parts of our program?
Yes. Yeah, let's do it. So on the one hand, we're going to be offering continuing education classes. So classes that therapists can take, as part of their continuing ed requirements, regardless of where they are in their licensure journey. And the other part, the most exciting part to us, I think, is that we're going to be launching a comprehensive supervision and training program for therapists in Oregon. And that means that we're going to be bundling in the intensive one-on-one and group mentorship of clinical supervision for pre-licensed clinicians with postgraduate training so that therapists can enter licensure feeling like they know what the fuck they're doing and they're ready to enter independent practice, not just sort of floating around stressed out about where to go next.
And as we continue talking today, we're going to talk to you about the details of that and our values and our mission and flesh it out more. And I think one of the most exciting parts of how this has evolved for us is that we have realized through our work in the field that people don't always leave graduate school feeling prepared to do therapy, which is,
you I'm know, just laughing at the level of understatement. The level of understatement. Okay, go on.
And, you know, we've talked about that on the podcast before, but I think that in some ways it's a function of the training and the pressure to give, you know, graduate students in counseling little bits of everything, right? And not the sort of depth of experience or knowledge or training that is necessary. And that's also a normal part of the journey of being a counselor, is that a lot of this you do have to just learn on the job. And those first couple years of your career out of grad school are immensely foundational for how you feel about this career, how you feel about the work you do, and how much you learn. So excitingly, I'm going to drop this in there, and Reva, you can pick it up. I think the thing that's going to be different about this program is that we're grounding it in like two fundamental philosophies and practices. One is relational psychotherapy practices that really are grounding clinical work in the relationship inside of therapy, which we know is a huge part of how people heal and work through their shit. And we'll talk more about that. And both of our unique passion for trauma treatment, particularly exposure-based trauma treatment and mentalization-based work. So we are hoping that that really allows people to launch into their careers with much more of a strong foundation than if they would have come out of school, just got general supervision, maybe took a one modality training, right? And so we're hoping that this program is really an extension of graduate school with strong community principles, strong mentorship, and we're really excited.
Yes, we are. So I'm gonna riff on some of the things you said. So first thing, people who are coming out of counseling and psychology graduate programs are underprepared by those programs, full stop. That is true. There are a number of reasons for that. I don't know that we need to get into all those reasons about why graduate school education has gone in the direction that it has over the past years and decades in terms of teaching people how to do therapy or not. But I will say, I think it's solidly true that people are coming out of those programs underprepared. And also, there is no way without an extremely radical ground up rehauling of those programs that people could come out prepared, because this is the kind of work that you actually need an apprenticeship based model to really get good at. I mean, you can get good at it without that, but it's a hell of a lot harder. That's what we're trying to work on here. The way that the licensure process works with supervised practice is supposed to be that, I think. You know, there's an idea that it's that. And I don't think that's most people's experience. I think most people's experience now is that supervision is often not super deep. The supervisor-supervisee relationship is often undercultivated, underutilized, doesn't reach its potential in terms of influencing supervisees, preparing them for independent practice, and I think is really negatively impacted by risk management, where it's often, I think, seen as like the time period where somebody's in supervised practice, it's just about making sure they don't fuck somebody up,
right.
Versus actually like making them an incredible therapist. We don't want to do that. We want to make incredible therapists. And so we are really trying to bring back a more robust and substantial apprenticeship lens, community of learning lens to postgraduate education and supervision.
Thank you for expanding on those things, Reva. And I think that one of the things that ends up being missing from graduate training because of all of the curriculum / accreditation demands, and perhaps a culture of liability as well, is there's just a lack of the person, of the therapist work happening. And so
yes,
we're really motivated to get into shit with people about how their personal struggles as human beings on this earth, their own histories, as we've discussed on this podcast before, parentification and many other things, and how to like work on that stuff and like turn it into part of the tool that you're using to do the good work. Because I think, you know, some of the stuff Reva and I study is really kind of some of the stuff that's gotten lost in master's level training in terms of relational interventions, sort of some of the relational psychodynamic theories that, you know, just don't get enough airtime. And we're just excited to get into it with people and really create this learning community, as Reva referred to, that is robust, a group of critical thinkers, a group of people who want to do good work in this current, you know, context we're working in right now. And that's no joke to be doing that in 2024. And so we're excited to create those communities.
Totally. Well, and I also think, you know, one of the things you alluded to that I think I would like to underline is just that this is, we want to propose this as an alternative to prematurely jumping into specialization in a particular modality. And why is that important? The way that, I mean, first of all, no matter what fucking modality you use, you're using foundational therapist skills. Again, myth that those are adequately taught in graduate school. We're working on our foundational therapist skills career long as we're doing this work. And certainly not anywhere done with those foundational skills the minute we get our master's degree. And again, you look at the research does not privilege any particular modality over another. The self of the therapist and the therapeutic relationship, pretty much across the board in the research on this topic, show that those factors are much, much more significant than a particular modality in most cases. I think there's some exceptions to that, but in most cases. And so the problem, one of the many problems with immediately diving into a particular modality is that I think it gives people a false sense of security. Of like, oh, if I know how to do these interventions and I feel secure in this modality, I can relax about my anxiety about being a therapist, when really there's foundational stuff that's getting missed. Another problem being, like, can we just talk about how expensive those trainings are? I mean, all of those modality trainings, like, people come out of grad school stressed out and insecure because they know they're underprepared. I very rarely talk to a therapist who's come out of their master's program not feeling that way. And so there's a sense of like, okay, I need to shore up my these areas that I don't feel confident. And then there's all these modality organizations sitting right there ready to make as much money off of beginning therapists as they possibly can. And I, you know, I've had my modality trainings. I don't knock it. I think they have their place and they're useful, but I don't think it's necessarily the right place for an early career therapist to start. And I do think there is a way in which there's a little whiff of desperation of getting into those before they've had the time and space to really consider, like, what does this do for me? Does this really work for me? Is this the right direction I want to go in? Because there's a desperation to like feel like you know what you're doing real quick.
Mm-hmm. And I think even if people come out of school feeling really prepared, which that's great if they do, I think there's so much growth in that first couple years that can be capitalized on in a cohort model of supervision, consultation, watching videos, learning together in a more intentional way. And I know as a clinical supervisor for a long time, I end up piecemealing all of that because I just don't have enough time. I don't have enough time, right? So with all that I have to, you know, or all the things that my supervisees want to learn and get better at, it's like bits and bobs or pieces. And it's just like, you know, it's exciting to think about doing that much more intentionally and with more just robustness and consistency in terms of like, imagine people are in a 2-year program after they finish school and they get a bunch of additional learning with us and a bunch of, you know, solid supervision and collegial relationships where they get feedback. And, you know, hypothetically in 2 years, people are eligible for licensure in Oregon if they have gotten their hours. It just feels like what I wish I had, right? And we're creating the thing that we wish we had. And it's based on our own experiences of learning in this field. And a lot of that learning is hard fought. And I don't want people to struggle as much as I did, you know?
Totally. Yes. Yeah. No, I longed for more like involved mentorship and community. And I hear that over and over from my therapist clients, you know, and other like younger or, you know, early career therapists that I know. I hear so many, well, and even people like well into their careers about the lack of community. And not just the lack of community in the sense of like knowing other therapists, but in the sense of like getting real, like getting really real about what it's like to do this work and the shit that comes up for us and the shit that comes up in the room and the shit that comes up at home, because this is a life-changing, you know, it touches every part of your life, this job. And being able to have people that you can get real about that with, you know, just thinking about grad school, it's like I was lucky in that I had a really, my cohort was very tight in grad school, but it's still like you're in such a fishbowl in terms of like proving your, you know, academic prowess and am I good enough to be a therapist and knowing that you're being scrutinized in that way. It really inhibits, I think, unless, you know, programs are really doing a ton to be able to push back and mitigate this in some way, it really inhibits actually doing substantive self of the therapist work, because like to get into the real shit of self of the therapist work, you have to be vulnerable and talk about your shortcomings and deal with the like deep-seated shit that's coming up for you. And I think in grad school, there's so much implicit pressure to perform like that's not happening, even though it's happening for all of us. We wouldn't have gotten into this field if it wasn't. And we want to make a place where that is welcome. And that's, yeah, that's part of the work, not an impediment to it.
Absolutely. And all of that fodder can be utilized. And being real about the work and not being performative about it, right? But grappling really intensely about the challenges of it, because we can always try and oversimplify what the work is, but it is utterly complex. And our field sometimes wants to collapse all of those complexities and paradoxes, as you've discussed on the podcast. And we just want all that complexity and grappling to be kind of held in a way that is transformative for therapists and allows their growth to kind of excel. And I do think people really fight very hard to grow in this field. And I think they do their best to use supervision. And as I've stated before, I love seeing that growth over that 2 to 3 year timeline. But I think so much can happen if it's more concentrated. And I think that the other piece of that too, going to more specifics that we should talk about, is just our passion for trauma treatment. And all of the things we might have to say about that in terms of that is a place where we do have some stronger opinions about which modalities are effective or which ones we believe to be effective or which ones the research says are effective. So we should talk about that a little bit, because trauma treatment, I believe, is like a foundational part of psychotherapy. And you can get really particular about diagnoses and protocols and all of this stuff, but a great deal of our clients, especially clients that return for therapy, come back for long-term therapy, have trauma to process. So you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, also in our, you know, just to contextualize the kind of thing that we're going to be offering beyond the comprehensive program, that our continuing ed offerings are going to be within those three umbrellas of self of the therapist work, relational psychotherapy, and trauma processing. And so, you know, one of the things that I talk to clients about sometimes, because I do try to be transparent about, you know, when people are interested about things like, you know, the research showing that modalities are minimally relevant and so forth. But one of the things that I talk about when it comes to trauma processing is that some of the common factors research does say that one of the important factors in successful psychotherapy outcomes is confrontation of avoided content. And to me, that really speaks volumes about the kind of trauma processing work that you and I do, about the value of it, because avoidance is what drives post-traumatic sequelae, and confrontation of avoided content means exposure work, even if you're not calling it that. You know, I think a lot of people who are doing successful psychotherapy around clients' trauma are doing exposure work, whether they're using a specific modality and using that terminology or not. But I think we stand behind that very strongly, about the importance of exposure and the way that it stands in for that idea of confronting avoidance and the content that clients are avoiding.
Yeah, and that confrontation of avoided content is really, I think, relevant in all aspects of doing psychotherapy, you know, because, you know, even if people don't have a sort of PTSD diagnostic kind of presentation, again, they might have those relational or self impacts because of their historical interpersonal developmental trauma that makes them feel avoidant in their lives of conflict, avoidant of connection, right? You could be on any end of that continuum.
Or all of them.
Yes. Exactly, exactly. And people suffer significantly, I think, from their historical childhood experiences, as well as from very significant interpersonal trauma. And I think I've learned a lot from you, Reva, vis-a-vis your training with Dr. David Schnarch about the nuance of working with interpersonal trauma versus other types of trauma, single incident trauma, accidents, disasters, death.
It's always driven me nuts. Sorry to interrupt, but it's always driven me nuts how the way that so often the examples given and the in training around how to manage trauma in the clinical setting, the examples given so often are single incident traumas, which you almost never encounter in the clinical population. What we're looking at mostly is complex interpersonal trauma. Whether that amounts to a complex PTSD presentation, like you said, or not, we're looking at multiple event, ongoing, chronic, relational traumatization. And the way that single event or more simple, you know, traumas are emphasized, I don't think it's doing clinicians any favors when your client is throwing you into the deep end with, you know, something that happened 300 times in the course of their childhood or whatever you've got, you know.
Yeah, and I think you've, you know, brilliantly highlighted some of this tension in your previous podcast eps when you've talked about anti-exposure bias. And, you know, we fight that battle pretty significantly together as colleagues, in terms of our idea that we have seen exposure-based traumatic memory work be much more effective than any other kind of passive or present-based trauma work. And we are super interested in helping clinicians understand that we are being trained in a current environment that is a bit anti-exposure based in trauma. And there's a lot out there about this kind of work, despite there being such a robust, lengthy, extensive clinical research on the nature of exposure based trauma work. And we're really passionate about that. And we've had some really good outcomes with it. And we also really want to push back on the idea of our colleagues and professors and people in our field sort of assuming that this kind of work is quote unquote re-traumatizing.
Right. This is one of the many things that we want to push back on, is like this idea that, I mean, I just can't get past the way I think of it is like this idea that people's own stories are dangerous to them. You know, I find that to be an offensive idea, frankly. You know, it's also part and parcel of this ignorance of the history in the field, where the whole idea of, for example, you know, the ubiquitous idea now of phased trauma therapy comes from Judith Herman, Trauma and Recovery. Most people who use that idea don't know that it comes from her, but that is who it comes from. In that very same work, she really promotes the idea of the integration of people's actual stories, not only into their own, you know, I don't know that she used the language of narrative exactly, but not only into their own narratives, their own therapeutic experiences, but into the larger culture, the importance of integrating the stories and experiences and the knowledge that comes from trauma, and largely interpersonal trauma is what she was focusing on, into the broader culture. And so it's very bizarre to me to see people using that one idea of phase treatment and then completely throwing out this idea of the importance of the stories of trauma survivors.
Which is phase two of the three-stage model. That's right. Like going straight from safety and stabilization to integration without really examining the trauma. And I think that, you know, on our better days, I think we believe that, of course, other things can work for people, like, and that everyone doesn't have to do it this way. But this is what we do. This is where we've seen the results. And I've been trained in many things, including EMDR, including other exposure-based treatments. And really, if we believe this works, there's a strong research base for it. And if clients are down for it, right, like we want to be able to do this deep, difficult, challenging work. And it takes a lot of courage, for sure. And it takes a lot of wherewithal to do that work. But we're deeply passionate about it. And I think, like recently, I was doing a training on some of this work and someone kindly called me in and was like, well, you're just trashing the other treatments that don't do exposure. And I was like, totally fair. But I think that's because I feel like the underdog with some of this. But if I'm pushed, I do believe that the client and therapist can make a decision about what works and that a lot of different things can work. But I think that there's also deeper reasons why we do it this way that are kind of cultural, that are pushing back on the cultural paradigm of living in the United States, which is a particular place. And I would love it if you wanted to start the conversation on some of those deeper paradigm reasons why we confront interpersonal trauma so directly.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I think, and this is one of the things I talk about when I am training people around this, is that part of the motivation that people in general in the broader culture don't want to hear or engage with people's trauma stories is because if we really knew and we really absorbed that into the broader culture, we would have to change something because it's unacceptable. You know, the level of like child abuse, for example, you know, the amount of trauma that's happening to vulnerable individuals, the amount of domestic violence, the amount of sexual assault, childhood sexual abuse, what, pick anything. If we really absorbed that knowledge, it would feel intolerable to not do something about it. And that's very inconvenient because what's convenient is to keep, you know, the wheels of capitalism rolling along, keep people, you know, working, kind of functioning well enough that they can show up to work and make the economy go. So I really do believe that this kind of work is radical and political inherently. I think that right now, and this may be a West Coast thing, so I, you know, want to acknowledge there's like a regionality to it. Right now, I think that sort of trendy kind of lefty therapy is somatic and it's seen as counterculture. That's fine. It may be counterculture in its own way. But I really want to claim that being willing to hear and amplify and really go into the stories of trauma survivors is radical. That is not the conventional sort of dominant culture way of doing things. You know, I also want to highlight that we've gotten so far in this direction of fear of talking about clients' trauma that you and I are seeing things like therapists being unwilling to talk about it when the client wants to, which is not okay. That is harmful. For a therapist to be too afraid to sit with a client who wants to tell their story and to hear it and contain it and help that client grapple with the content, I think that's unacceptable. And I think it's unacceptable that early career clinicians are being trained with that level of fear. I think it's counter to everything that this field was supposed to be and counter to really the foundations of this work. So I think it's really important to have a place where we are really saying, like, this other, you know, just this other message, because this is a big pendulum swing.
It is. And I think when you're speaking about that, it reminds me of this idea that clinicians can be afraid of dysregulation and decompensation, right? But I think after observing and having so many conversations with colleagues, supervisees, fellow professors, I think people are more afraid of facing the moral injury of the harm that happens in this society. Like, as discussed, there's tons of it. But I think that might be a cover. Or we might be afraid of our ability to contain that decompensation and dysregulation. But to be truthful, I don't see that as a barrier to the work. Clients are quite courageous. They're quite resourceful. They are quite brave. And they have done, like, the work that I've seen is, like, as you've done and I've done, like, it's truly transformational if people are willing to go there and we're willing to go there with them. And I think it goes back to some of those cultural pieces you were talking about around upending the idea that everyone has done the best they could and everyone has just, you know, this idea of parents, caregivers, bystanders, harmers, perpetrators, antagonists, like that they all did the best they could. And I just think we're pushing back on that more culturally because you and I don't believe that's true.
Well, and we're also implicated. I think that, you know, when I've worked with, I was just talking to a client about this yesterday, about when I would go to the Schnarch trainings, you know, he was really clear that, and I think I'm getting into some language that some of our listeners won't understand, and that's okay, but we'll just touch on it briefly, that everybody's guilty of having caused somebody else traumatic mind mapping. We've all harmed people. I'm going to say we've all harmed people intentionally, whether we are aware of that or not, because we're not always aware of our own intentions. We've all caused harm to other people. Yes, there's a spectrum of that. But like in my trainings with him, he was very clear that none of us were, our hands were clean. And we really had to sit with that. And when I've taught this mentalization work, what I've seen in the people who've really taken it up and really picked up the concept and really ran with it is there's a lot of self-confrontation of harm that they've caused. Nobody wants to do that. It's horrible. To confront that within yourself, you have to have a very high tolerance for the shame, to see yourself in a negative light, to see your own motivations in a negive light, that is not how you want to see yourself. People don't want to do that. Therapists don't want to do that. When we're working honestly with interpersonal trauma, we have to deal with that within ourselves too and the implications of that. I actually think, you know, I've been doing this deep dive. I mean, I don't know how deep it is, but it's deep for me into psychoanalytic literature in the past year. I think psychoanalysts are way better at doing this than the rest of us because they have not let go of the idea of the unconscious. And so I see a lot more willingness in that set of therapists to look at some of this uglier material. And, you know, just to bring it back around, it's really, really important for many reasons, but one being that impacts our therapist-client relationships. We're not always perfect angels in those therapist-client relationships either. And so, like, there's a way that the kind of interpersonal trauma work that you and I do and the way that we look at it, it's also a lens to look at the therapeutic relationship and the things that happen in that relationship and to be able to really take ownership of who we are in that relationship, which is very confronting. I think what we're asking from therapists is a tall order, actually. And I've the stuff that I've had to confront in myself because of my work has been some of the most challenging stuff that I've ever had to confront anywhere. And I think that's the responsibility that we take on when we take on this job. And that's what I want to prepare therapists to do, whether that's through our our program or also in the classes, you know, that's the invitation. We chose to do a job where our willingness to confront ourselves and to grow through that self-confrontation is crucial. And so we need places where we are scaffolded in doing that. And that's what the kiln is supposed to be.
Boom. Thank you, Reva. Well, just to share a few of our continuing ed courses that we have developed and are developing, I think, Reva, you've had such an awesome passion that's developed around doing therapy with other therapists. And we're going to have a course on that will likely evolve into, you know, more than one thing, maybe perhaps courses, a couple different ones. And, you know, we're combining forces with the modality that I've used for about 13 years with the modality that Reva's been deeply trained in. And we're creating sort of a hybrid, which we're both very excited about, that we've both been using. And we're excited to share our material, our client material that has come out of that work, which is mentalization-based narrative exposure therapy, a comprehensive four-day training on those modalities and how to integrate them with very exciting applications and material and conversations that will provide, I think, a very deep foundation for people, even if they're at the beginning stage of thinking about trauma treatment versus and advanced practitioners who want to like amp up their skills in deepening their trauma work. And so we've been thinking about that and working on that and, you know, having Wednesday conversations about that for a long time. And we're excited about that. And then also coming out of your work with Schnarch, and something that I've been experimenting with that's been really exciting is using mental dialogues as an approach to process some interpersonal trauma. And I don't know if you want to say more about that, but I've been having a lot of fun with that in clinical work. It's been deeply challenging. But as an add-on to the foundation of the mentalization-based narrative exposure therapy work, we're going to do a training on mental dialogues.
What I think is cool about it is that a lot of people have done like dialogue-based work that is what I would call more like wish fulfillment-y, where it's like, oh, you know, do a dialogue with your parent and have them say what you wish they had said. I'm not saying that that can't be meaningful or cathartic or whatever for people. I'm sure it can. But what I think is cool about this method that Schnarch was teaching, and I'm going to go ahead and say, because I have some loyalty to his memory, he would not want me to be teaching this. He was very proprietary of his method. He did not want people going out and using it in a way that he did not have control over, which I understand because there's a lot of bullshit out there and people who have weird ideas. And he died. He died before he established a lineage of people who were going to train other people in this work. I know that there's the Crucible Institute has kind of been reestablished, and there are people who are out there kind of trying to carry it on in the best way that they can. And I also think that this is how ideas evolve, is that people take them and run with them and bring them forward. And my, you know, as I've wrestled with this over the past few years since his death, what I've come to in myself is like, I have more loyalty to the power of the work than I do to what he wanted. And he believed in that. He believed in differentiation. And so despite the fact that he wouldn't have liked that I'm doing it, I think he would have respected my differentiation from him. That's my caveat. But so this dialogue-based work is not about wish fulfillment. It's actually a very ingenious method of exposure therapy. And the exposure is to the relationship between the client and, you know, the term Schnarch used was antagonist. You could say perpetrator, you could say whatever. So we're talking about the context of relational trauma. And in the context of relational trauma, the locus of the trauma is the relationship. And so exposure to the relationship where the trauma occurred has a potent, you know, potential for healing. And you can do that imaginally. You can do it because people contain pretty accurate mental schemas of individuals who have been influential. And so by mentally accessing that relationship and doing these dialogues, you can use that as a site of change in the person's relationship to their antagonist. And you and I have found that to be very powerful. And I know from the trainings I did with Schnarch around this, I know that I found it to be powerful in my own work, as like my own personal work, as I've used my own material in those dialogues. I've seen that in the consult groups that I was in with people doing their own dialogues. It's really incredibly powerful work. It's unprecedented in terms of, like, I've never seen anyone else doing this kind of exact thing. And I have found it particularly effective with clients who really have difficulty responding to the sort of basic kind of trauma exposure therapy, you know, more narrative-based stuff. There's people whose defenses are real good. This kind of dialogue work can really break through that. People who are like really not emotionally accessing the trauma are able to access it through this method. So I'm really excited about starting to teach that. It'll definitely be in our training program, but it's going to be available on an ongoing basis as something we're teaching, you know, as part of our continuing ed. And I think as you've experienced, like, it's really something like you don't have to be perfect at it to see really amazing results to like when you start using it. It's a very powerful tool.
Two things. I want to say that the chapters in Brain Talk, which are very available, right? The book Brain Talk.
Yes, Schnarch's the book is widely available.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So there's a chapter in there that really does teach mental dialogues, and that is available to the masses. And I think Schnarch wanted that to be very transparently available to the masses.
True.
And I think that, you know, that book, despite its, you know, I think there's places where it's dense. It's really written for a possible client.
Totally. Well, and he did say there's somewhere in that book where he says, like, people don't have access to therapy often or good therapy. And he wanted the book to be a way that people could guide themselves through some of this process if they didn't have access. So that is true.
Right. And the idea that Schnarch thought that individuals could do this courageous, painful, brutal work on their own is also saying something. And I also want to say that I think the dialogues, I mean, we haven't talked much about narrative exposure therapy or mentalization because we just are kind of, this is less known to this approach.
Yeah.
I think the mental dialogues are very valuable for people who have complicated relationships with, let's say, parents and caregivers, where the trauma, whether you call that big T or little T trauma, I don't really.
Who cares?
Who cares?
I don't care what the T is.
Yeah. I don't either. I think that there's something about when your parents are doing their shit to you, that it's so difficult to see fully what's happening. And that might not be as potent as several incidences of explicit trauma over your lifespan. That might be like the general fuckery of that relationship. And I think that is deeply valuable to a lot of clients to look at the impact of those relationships with important people in their life. So anyway, that was kind of fun to talk about. We haven't talked about that very much. And I don't know if we want to say more, but what we're getting at here is that we do want to teach people a sort of comprehensive way of processing trauma material with their clients that is adaptive to whatever else they want to add too. So this is not a rigid approach that we're talking about. You know, this is based on some pretty significant fundamental principles of confronting avoidance, getting at the horrific details, looking at the traumatic mind mapping that's put on people by their perpetrators or antagonists. But there's so much flexibility in how you do it.
And in the context of a strong therapeutic relationship, you know, some of what we talked about in our episode on immediacy. You know, and I think that that's one of the things that's been cool about our partnership is I feel like, you know, you've really influenced me in that arena in terms of like really building my relational skills. And it synergizes with the trauma work incredibly well. You know, it's not like just a background note. It's something where if you really build a very powerful alliance with somebody and then you're doing that trauma work in that context, you really get the double whammy. And I think it's much more powerful than the sum of its parts.
Agreed.
Yeah. I think that we really envision this institution as a breath of fresh air, right? It's like, and I think that's what this podcast was supposed to be. And that's the feedback I get pretty consistently from listeners is like that we talk about things here that people feel and feel like they can't say. And we want the kiln to serve that purpose too. Like this work in so many ways is supposed to be about being able to talk about anything, you know, really being able to look at, talk about, being willing to see anything, things that people outside this room, so to speak, right, aren't willing to see, talk about, experience. And we don't do a great job living up to that as a professional culture. And I think that for you and I, what we want the kiln to be and represent and facilitate is for therapists, all of us, including us, you know, to do a better job living up to that. And I feel really optimistic about being able to do that through this means.
Absolutely. You know, we are, you know, synchronizing the release of this podcast with the release of the website for this project, which is thekilnschool.com. And we are hoping to start a cohort of postgraduates in fall of this year. And we imagine, and we're not just imagining, but we're working on a comprehensive curriculum related to some of these topics that we're discussing today that is not going to be quite as rigorous as grad school, but it's going to be pretty rigorous and supportive, and lots of knowledge will be shared and lots
juicy.
Of
juicy. I'm calling it juicy.
Juicy. Okay. Lots of, you know, lots of support, mentorship, collaboration, and supervision. And we imagine that to be, you know, a 2-year process. So we're creating the first year of curriculum and the second year of curriculum. And obviously, if people, you know, aren't licensed by then, we will continue with them as supervisors. And we just really are excited to just have that structured postgraduate approach where people can learn in a deep way and freely and, you know, with passion and with curiosity and with complexity.
And making mistakes. Everybody's fucking up. Let's just have it be part of it.
Yeah, fucking up. I mean, we're going to fuck up. I mean, let's get in there. Let's get away from performance. Let's get away from impression management. Let's get away from I just do it this way. And it's like, we've got to grapple with so much if we're going to keep this field relevant in the times that we're in. There's no way we can just rest on our laurels with like what's going on. So that's kind of what it looks like. But we're really hoping that those of you who are listening, who are interested, will go to the website and learn more about the possibilities and what the options are.
Right. And so that's fall of this year, 2024, for our first cohort, Oregon pre-licensed. That'll be like people who are LPC track and LMFT track. So that'll be starting in the fall. And then we're rolling out our a la carte continuing ed classes starting real soon this spring. And then they'll be rolling out just on a pretty regular basis from here on out. I'm excited. And I'm excited for, you know, I have made quite a few connections through this podcast and heard from therapists all over the country and out of the country. And it's been really exciting to make those connections and hear from so many of you. And I would love to, I've met a few of you through my classes and consult groups so far and would love to meet more of you as we're launching some of these courses in the spring and afterwards.
Yeah. And I also just want to add that it's not just going to be just us. We're going to have visiting faculty that have different identities than us, that have different specialties than us, that kind of will ensure that our supervisees have some of the more practical knowledge that they need in this time of practicing. So we're building up something that will be, you know, that will fill in a lot of those gaps. And again, not just us, but we're really going to make sure that people have everything they need by the time they're done.
Yep.
As much as possible anyway. So we're excited to do this with you, the listeners, whoever's interested, and we're excited to work with some of our colleagues in the field to launch this program and bring them in to accent the stuff we're doing. So it's really exciting, and it is indeed a labor of love. I know you've heard me on the podcast with Reva before, and this has been in the works the whole time, and hours and hours of complex conversation and research, and ideas and processing our personal experiences with the work, supporting each other with our clients, supporting each other with the trauma treatment. And like, we're
dozens,
thrilled.
Dozens of voice notes back and forth.
Then we're going to write a book with those voice notes. I just appreciate this partnership a lot. And I appreciate all the beautiful conversations we've been able to have and the conversations I've had with my friends and colleagues in the field and supervisees based on your podcast and some of the other listeners or guests you've had on. And I can't wait for the next season of the podcast in general.
Yes, we have some good stuff coming up really soon.
Well, check out thekilnschool.com. We look forward to hearing from you.